Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're very happy to be with you on this fine spring morning.
Yeah, right.
And today, what's on the agenda, Rabideau?
Well, we have almost a scoop. Not quite a scoop, because they wouldn't allow us to do it anyway, but the James Beard Awards are happening.
The Journalism
very, very, Awards. Very, very shortly, and the Journalism Awards.
They're done.
They just happened, and it turns out, guess who interviewed one of the guys who was, not fortunate enough to win an award. He won an award because his book is really absolutely terrific. And you'll be absolutely thrilled to listen to this young man who produced a book called
The Food Lab.
The Food Lab, yeah, which won a big award at the BBJ James Beard Awards recently. But not only that.
That's the name of his column.
SeriousEats.com. This is a serious guy, but with a fine sense of humor. And
he's my best friend.
Yeah, and a lot. And a lot you can learn. So let's let our listeners get on with listening and learning.
Kenji Lopez out.
We're going to be talking to somebody that I'd like to have a long dinner with, Kenji. He's funny. He's smart. He knows what he's talking about.
You'd want to make him cook, though, because I sure as hell wouldn't want him judging my cooking.
That's for sure. But anyway, we're talking to Kenji Lopez Alt, who is the managing culinary director for a very popular website called Serious Eats. And he's also the author of this book, which is what we're going to be discussing, that everybody has raved about, called The Food Lab: Better Home Cooking Through Science. And I have to tell you, I've interviewed a lot of these food science people, Kenji, and you're the only one that actually gave me chuckles when I was reading the book.
Yeah, well, scientists tend to be pretty dry, I think.
Oh, indeed. So, well, we interviewed Hervé Tisse in his lab, which was really heavy duty.
He's a very serious scientist.
Oh, wow. He wants everything to be chemical. But
Harold McGee was pretty serious, too.
Yeah, but he could be a little bit funnier. But no. but this Kenji guy is hilarious. I mean, absolutely hilarious. And let's talk about it. I mean, it's such a massive tome. I mean, it's like you need to actually have some gym time to be able to lift this book. It's just right. under 1,000 pages, right?
Yeah, 950, something like that. Yeah.
Right. And I said to Kenji that probably the easiest thing to do would be to say what's not in it as opposed to what's in it.
Desserts, yeah.
And, of course,
no desserts in the book.
What's not in it is desserts, which you and I have the same feeling about that. I'm not so interested in desserts anyhow. So
yeah, just give me a slice of cheese and I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly. Piece of fruit, slice of cheese. So let's start at the beginning. Is you think that you really can't have freedom in the kitchen until you actually know the science of what you're cooking?
Well, it's not, you know, there are ways around that. What I liken it to is, say you move into a new neighborhood, right? And you're trying to figure out the lay of the land, and you're trying to, say, get from your house to the grocery store. And maybe the first time you go, you're just following turn-by-turn directions on your phone. And that'll get you from your house to the grocery store, but you don't really figure out what's going on, right? You don't really get a lay of the land that way. You don't get a mental picture of the entire neighborhood. And it's only once you start sort of exploring the side street, or maybe looking at a map and seeing it from a bird's eye view, that you really get to understand what's going on in that neighborhood. Uh-huh. And, you know, and sure, you can, if you live your whole life and in that neighborhood and you learn all the streets just naturally by going places, eventually you're going to pick up all the tips and tricks that you're going to need to get you from A to B or wherever you want to go. But I think you get to that stage much faster if you actually go and look at a map and study it for a little bit. And that's sort of what food science is for me. You know, a recipe is just a turn-by-turn direction that gets you from A to B. But understanding the science and technique behind it, that's sort of like looking at a map of the whole thing. And that's what really helps you understand how you got from point A to point B and maybe what other routes you could possibly take to get to the same destination or maybe to get to a different destination.
Well, you present all this information, and it's a ton of information, in a really appealing manner. Not only is it interwoven with your own sort of kind of quirky sense of humor, if you don't mind my saying so. But you
who knew that Japanese people had a sense of humor?
What?
they're not known for it, are they?
No, probably not.
I don't know. The comics are very popular. Anyhow, this you have a degree in architecture. I don't think you ever actually practiced it, did you?
No, the closest I've gotten is right now when we're remodeling our house, so I get to kind of put things together in here now, but that's about it.
Well, I must say that I was knocked out by your photographs. You photographed this book yourself.
And I did.
I'm looking at this egg thing you did where the eggs were all boiled for from between 0 and 12 minutes. I mean, it's a work of art.
Well, thank you. You know, that one to me was just something. It's just like, how do I show people? You know, it's very easy to describe. I'm sorry, very difficult to describe things to say. Oh, you know, if you want an egg that has a slightly soft center but a white that's barely set, and blah blah blah. You know, you can describe an egg a million ways, but if you just show one picture, it's much easier. So I was trying to basically find a picture that shows people how an egg cooks from the outside in as it's boiling, and that just seemed like an obvious way to do it to me. Boiling eggs and pulling one out every 30 seconds. And it ended up looking pretty cool, I think.
You know, the funniest thing is I've been boiling eggs for probably...
I eat them every morning.
Almost 70 years.
And we're doing it wrong.
I didn't know until we interviewed someone, and this came up in a conversation, I can't even remember why, that if you that it's really bad to boil an egg for too long. So even if you want hard-boiled eggs, you should be stopping the cooking process after like 10 minutes. If you cook it 15 minutes, you sort of really dry it all out, and it affects the color and the flavor of the eggs. And I never even thought about that.
Oh, yeah, it does. You know, I wouldn't say it's wrong or bad, you know, because there are some people, like my wife, for instance, enjoys that that flavor of very, very hard-cooked eggs. And so, you know, and some, for me, if that egg starts to get that greenish tinge around the yolk, that's a sign that it's overcooked.
It's
I don't really want to get anywhere near it.
It tastes
exactly.
So
but there's some cultures that really enjoy it. So my wife likes it that way. In some Asian cultures, you'll cook eggs for up to a couple hours, and they come out with a very sort of unique texture and strong flavor, which to me is a turnoff. But you know, I wouldn't necessarily say it's wrong. It's just different.
Well, Wiley Dufresne had us all excited, this was a number of years ago, about his 55 or 54 minute egg, and we sat through that whole process and everything, and we got it, and it was interesting, and the texture was interesting, but it was a coddled egg, is what it was.
it turns out, Kenji, that we are, probably the only two people in these United States, with the possible exception of yourself, who own not just one egg coddler, but two. somebody sent them to us as a gift.
And we also
we have
an egg piercer, and also a thing to lop off the top of
the
it.
The loppers are now widely available.
Yeah, but
you're my type of people. I love eggs.
Yeah, but
Wiley Dufresne, who you just mentioned, loves. I know he loves eggs as well. We've talked a lot about.
Were you
about
in
eggs.
That book, the egg book I had?
No, I was not.
He was in that. No, he loves eggs.
Well, now let's go back. Let's go back to the subject here. And
to say that we have been cooking eggs wrong all these years because your brother-in-law and I have had this ongoing debate about whether you soft-boil eggs by starting them in cold water or plopping them into boiling water. And
right.
I said cold, and I'm wrong. And you say boiling, but even your timing is very different from mine. I use jumbo eggs, put them in the water, bring it to boil time, 4 minutes, and that's how I like them.
And they're perfect.
But they're wrong.
Got it.
But no.
Well, it's not that they're wrong. It's just that, you know, it's smooth peeling, easy peeling is a feature that you find important in a boiled egg. You're going to get there better if you drop them into already hot water than if you do them in cold water. Because if you start them in cold water, the egg whites end up very slowly coagulating and end up fusing to the membrane inside the shell. Whereas if you start them in hot water, they very quickly. It's sort of like if you put a piece of chicken in a cold pan and bring it up to temperature, that chicken's going to stick to the pan. But if you start with a hot pan,
that's true. Yeah.
The chicken doesn't stick, and it's the same with eggs. If you lower them into boiling water, the shells are much less likely to stick. It's not 100% guaranteed, but the shells are much less likely.
We'll have to try that. We're not too old that we can't change our ways.
Well, tell me this. Somebody getting this book, now how would you – you had two theories here. One, some people are just going to breeze through it, cooking the recipes, and you weren't so fond of that. And then there were some people that were just going to read the book and not cook any of the recipes, and you were a little bit more fond. But ultimately, what do you want people to do with this book?
Well, I never thought of it as a recipe book. You know, there are recipes in there. There's several hundred recipes in there. But for me, the important parts are the stuff in between the recipes, the lessons you learn from them. So, you know, the recipes themselves are always just sort of anchor points to get people into the science. Because you know, I find that learning science in a vacuum is a little bit boring. It's like going to a college lecture, and I never really liked lectures. You know, so learning the science of searing meat is not really that interesting. But learning about searing a steak, that is interesting. So if you can fold the science lesson into a thing about the steak or the meatloaf or the macaroni and cheese, that's how you get people to really learn the science and for that knowledge to stick. So my ultimate goal is for people to read the book, maybe cook the recipes if they want to, but ideally, you know, after you've read the entire book and you understand the science and the technique, you shouldn't really need the recipes, because you know, the recipes, again, are sort of the turn-by-turn directions, but once you have a map, you don't really need those turn-by-turn directions. You can plan your own routes out. And of course, you know, if you're in a hurry or you don't want to bother studying that map and thinking and planning your route, you can follow the turn-by-turn directions and the recipes and you'll get to the end just fine. But it's really more about learning the techniques. And I think that's what eventually frees you from having to use recipes. It lets you look at any recipe that anyone else has written or look at a dish that someone else has made, and you should be able to sort of reverse engineer it and figure out how they did it and then reconstruct it to suit your own taste.
Well, you're mentioning that about techniques leads me to my next question. Could you explain exactly how you organized this book?
Well, it's organized by technique, by principle. So it's not, you know, it's a traditional cookbook might be breakfast and lunch and dinner and dessert. This one is mainly organized along techniques. So there's a chapter on everything that you would deep fry. So that's everything from, you know, onion rings to fried chicken to chicken fried steak to tempura. Then there's a chapter that's on eggs and breakfast. I mean, it's a breakfast chapter. Really, it's mostly about eggs and the science of eggs, because eggs are such a hugely fascinating topic for me. Then there's a chapter on sort of searing and quick cooking meat, a chapter on stews and braises and stocks and stuff like that, a chapter on emulsions, which is basically about salads, because, you know, the most common emulsion you're going to make is in a salad dressing, mayonnaise or vinaigrette or things like that. You know, emulsions are very, very prevalent in the kitchen. They come up time and time again in the kitchen, and understanding how they work will give you better food and better salads. And then a chapter on vegetables. And I think there's a few other chapters in there that I can't recall off the top of my head. But it's mainly got around, each chapter is based on a single technique, because I think that's how you really understand. You know, once you understand that cooking a chicken breast is not really that different from cooking a steak, or even that different from, say, curing a hamburger, you know, or that making a hamburger is not that different from making a sausage or from making a meatball or meatloaf. Once you start drawing those connections in your head, I think that's, at least for me, that's when things really started clicking. That, you know, it wasn't just about learning how to make meatloaf, but it was learning about how to work with ground meat in general and sort of the principles of how ground meat interacts with other ingredients. That's what really sort of makes it click.
What are two or three of the things that you think were your most important pieces of knowledge that you either had or acquired or that you put in the book? Like the one we just talked about of putting eggs in boiling water rather than in cold water. I mean, what are maybe two or three of the really more important things that you think are in there?
It's hard to say more important because that, I think different people are going to find different things important because it all depends on what kind of food you like to eat and like to cook. I can tell you what some people, what people tend to jump onto as sort of important in changing their habits in the kitchen. One of them is how like pasta in the book. I was always taught to use a gigantic pot of water when you're cooking pasta, at least a gallon of water per pound, and that you need to put it into a big pot of already boiling water, otherwise the pasta's going to stick to itself. And that is true if you're using fresh pasta or if you're using a very, very specific type of very traditionally made pasta that is, you know, pressed through brush dyes and still cooked at a, still dried out at a low temperature. Modern pasta is not made that way. Modern pasta is pressed through Teflon dyes. Has a much smoother surface and it's dried at a higher temperature, so a lot of the starches in it are already set, which means that even if you boil pasta in a small pot of water, it's not really going to stick to itself. So you can actually take dry pasta, put it in a pot, cover it with cold water, stick it on the stove, just give it a quick stir or two at the beginning, and then bring it to a boil and then just put a lid on it and shut it off and set it to the side, and it comes out completely indistinguishable from pasta that you put into already boiling water. And it's actually better to cook this way for a few reasons. First is that it saves time because you don't have to bring a giant pot of water to boil, and you don't have to wait for the water to boil before you put the pasta in. It saves energy, of course, because you're not bringing that much water to a boil. You're just boiling a small pot. Saves water. And more importantly, it also makes everything taste better in the end because as anyone who's cooks a lot of Italian food can tell you, one of the tricks is to always add a little bit of that starchy pasta water to the sauce when you toss the pasta with the sauce, because that helps the sauce emulsify better, it helps it cling to the pasta better, it makes the whole thing taste better. So when you start with a really large pot of water, the pasta water has a very low concentration of starch in it at the end, particularly with modern pasta. If you start with a smaller volume of water, however, you get a very good concentration of starch in there, which means that it will make the texture of your sauce come out much better in the end as well. Let's see, that's one of them. I mean, you know, another one of the big points, one of the big takeaways I try and press on people is to rely on thermometers rather than timers, particularly when you're cooking meat, because, you know, there's so many variables between where recipes are tested and your home kitchen. You know, and every oven is different. Every piece of meat is different. The one constant thing I can tell you, though, is that if you cook a steak to 130 degrees, that's going to be medium rare, no matter what the size of the steak, no matter how you cooked it. If the center of that steak is 130 degrees, the center of that steak is going to be medium rare. So it's much better to rely on an accurate thermometer than it is to rely on any other sort of measuring device. Timers are terrible for things like that. A lot of chefs will tell you, you know, poke your steak.
It's part of your hand.
And I think what a lot of chefs forget, though, is that that method works for them only because they cook hundreds of steaks a day, every day of their life, and they have some kind of frame of reference. You know, the average home cook is cooking maybe a couple steaks per year, and you're not going to have any kind of frame of, you know, when you poke a steak, it's like, how do I know what this is? How do I know how well done this is? You know, and they say maybe, like, poke your cheek and see if it feels like your cheek, and that's medium rare. But it's like, you know, my cheek is not the same as your cheek. Is my cheek medium rare or is your cheek medium rare? A thermometer is the way to go when you want to tell how well done your meat is.
Now, you have this section. I can't pass by this. I'm not sure I understand it. The beer cooler as a pot for sous vide. Could you explain that?
Oh, yeah. Well, so sous vide cooking is a relatively modern form of cooking. It was invented in the 70s, really became much more popular in the early 2000s in restaurants. But these days, there's devices at home that people can use that cost a couple hundred bucks. The idea is that when you're cooking sous vide, you generally are cooking meat. You'll take your meat and put it in a vacuum sealed bag or in a Ziploc bag with all the air pressed out. And then you lower it into a water bath that's set at a very precise temperature. So it's generally set at the temperature that you want to serve your meat. So if I'm cooking a steak and I want it medium rare, I would set it to between 125 and 130 degrees Fahrenheit. And I would lower my steak in there and then let it sit. And you can let it sit for anywhere between an hour up to around 4 or 5 hours. And it won't really change in quality. It'll be perfectly evenly cooked from edge to center anywhere in that time window, which means that, you know, for a restaurant or for someone at home who doesn't know exactly when dinner is going to be on the table, I think it's really useful, and it's completely foolproof in terms of getting your meat to hit the right temperature. So when you're ready to serve it, all you have to do is take it out of the bag, give it a nice sear to get some color on the outside, and then you have a perfect steak every time, and it's repeatable and it's consistent. Sous vide devices, not everyone has them at home.
They're
so if you want to try this method,
they
can be expensive. You know, at the time that I started writing that book, they were still thousands of dollars. These days, they're down to about $200.
But it's still an investment. Yeah.
It's still an investment for someone who's not sure that they want to try something completely new. So a good way to test it out without having to buy that equipment is to actually just cook inside a cooler. Coolers are insulated. They're designed to keep things cold, but they're also quite good at keeping hot things hot. So you can take a beer cooler, fill it up with hot tap water or water that you boiled on the stove if you don't want to use your hot tap water. Use a thermometer and get it to 130 degrees. And then take a steak, put it in a plastic bag, press all the air out, and just drop it in that cooler, cover it up, and come back about an hour later, and your steak will be perfectly cooked, from my chef, just as if you had done it in a sous vide cooker. If you want to do, the one downside of beer cooler sous vide is that you can't do, there are some recipes that require you to cook for, say 72 hours at a time if you want to make really tender short ribs,
right,
for example. And you can't do that in a cooler.
No.
But any of the sort of quick cooking, an hour or under recipes that are designed for sous vide, you can do them directly in a cooler without having to have that expensive equipment.
Mm. Yeah, one of the more interesting things that was steak, if you like, done in a sous vide method was our friend Kevin Sousa. You remember he was he had a restaurant and he had three sous vide machines, and basically everything he was cooking was cooked sous vide, and he sous vided.
Oh yeah,
and they were absolutely wonderful.
But they were around for a long time.
The big problem with short ribs is they disappear. If you cook them in a conventional manner, even if you braise them for a long time.
They lose about half their volume.
They lose a whole lot of their volume, and you don't always drink all the gravy. I mean, eventually, at some point, you're going to throw it away. So I thought that was quite brilliant.
Yeah, it's great for that because, the amount of liquid that a piece of meat loses is pretty much directly proportional to the temperature you're cooking it at. I'm sorry, my dog seems to be going a little wild right now.
It's okay.
Hope we're not cooking your dog.
A traditional braising, you're braising at like 180, 190 degrees, probably something around there. And so you do lose a lot of volume. With sous vide, you're cooking a short rib at something closer to like 140 degrees. So you lose much, much less moisture as it cooks. And it gets a sort of unique texture, a very different texture than you would with a traditional braise. It's sort of juicier and doesn't have sort of the stringiness. I'm not necessarily convinced one way is better than the other, but, sous vide is a tool like any other, and it can get you to end results that are different from the results that other tools will get you.
Yeah, and Kenji, and I think just one final question. Go ahead.
Well, no, this one is a double-barreled question.
Oh, dear. You always ask double-barreled questions.
I know, but, Peter asked you, what are the surprising things, new things that you gave to the readers. I wanted to ask, first of all, you said that this was no way comprehensive, this book, because science is always exploring. Are there any further developments over the course of this book that you've discovered that you'd want to share with the potential readers, a change of mind, a change of results, or anything like that, something new and different? That you've discovered.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, what I just mentioned earlier about the pasta, so in the book I talk about cooking dry pasta with, a small volume of water starting to cold. And I say that it can be done with any dry pasta. Since writing that, I've actually discovered that there are exceptions to that. And so the exception I mentioned was if you're using, a very traditionally made brand of pasta. Generally, they're imported Italian brands that are very expensive.
And they use bronze.
So if you're using those pastas, they actually won't work very well with this method. So that's something that I do need to update at some point with the next edition, maybe.
Well, what they told us, we visited two different pasta factories in Abruzzo and Le Marche, and they said very, very important that you use bronze dyes, because the bronze dyes left a surface on the pasta that was abraded that allowed the sauce to stick. And if you used Teflon dyes, your sauce would just sink to the bottom of the bowl.
Yes, and that is true. They do cling to sauce better. So when I'm cooking a meal for somebody else, I generally do buy those more expensive pastas that are extruded with the bronze dyes, because they take sauce better, and they generally, I think, have a better texture as well. But the reality is that in the U.S. and even in Italy, you know, Berea is the number one selling pasta brand in Italy. The vast majority of pasta that people are cooking is extruded through Teflon dyes, not bronze.
What's our favorite, love?
Rusticella.
Yeah, we actually.
Yeah, that's the brand I generally use as well.
We went to the factory with the owner.
Oh, great! They make great pasta.
There's one thing I'd like Peter to do, because it's he repeats the story over and over again, but I think that it's really appropriate to this whole concept of science of cooking is about the roast where you cut off the...
Yeah.
I listened to this one, Kenji.
This is a funny one. This is a family recipe handed down from generation to generation to generation. We'll pretend just for the purposes of example that my mother is the subject of the story, and she learned from her mother that when she was cooking a tri-tip roast, which she called in England a salmon cut, it's that triangular sort of pointed end of
There's
the sirloin.
There's a picture of it in this book, yeah.
And the instructions said you have to cut the triangular portion off at this distance from the end. And the daughter kept on doing that and kept on doing that and kept on doing that. And then one day she finally plucked up the courage to ask her mother why that was in the recipe. having cooked a salmon cut sirloin roast for about 50 years, it turned out that that was the only way to get the sirloin tip roast to fit in the pan.
Her mother had a small oven, right?
No, it wasn't the oven. It was the pan. The roasting pan itself. You had to put the piece you cut off into a different pan.
Well, Kenji, I think this is just great. And I think people who like the book could also follow your columns. You do special articles on things as well. And you did a video series, huh?
We're always experimenting with new formats. So I've done a bunch of video stuff. Some of it free, some of it is behind a paywall. I'm actually currently working on a new video series where it's all a bunch of really short and snappy cooking videos that are shot in first person. So like with a camera strapped to my face, so that you're seeing everything sort of from the cook's eye perspective. Which a lot of people, I think it'll help a lot of people because you can only describe so much with words, but if you can really see it from the perspective of the cook, I think that helps you understand the sort of subtle things that cooks do that maybe they don't even realize they're doing, but it all becomes clear in a video.
You made the world of cooking truly fascinating with another dimension.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we're thankful for your doing that, because we get to read a lot of books and we enjoyed reading yours. So thank you very much. Compared to the last 53 before that. and listeners, you should get this. And let's see if you buy Thomas Keller's from Under Pressure, you can make pressed sandwiches between them without having to exert any force. And somebody's beeping us. They need to communicate with us telephonically. So let's say goodbye and thank you so much.
Yeah, Kenji, so great meeting you.
Hey, it was great to talk to you guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I'm going to start a guest list for a dinner party I want to have for people that I thoroughly enjoy, who have not only a firm grasp of all the science involved in food and cooking, but who also have a fabulous sense of humor. And Kenzie's right at the top there. And I also want Wiley Dufresne.
There you go.
And any suggestions you have that fit the bill, just email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com.
No, you don't want the Queen of England and the President of the United States.
No, I don't.
You don't want those guys.
Sense of humor and knowledge of food science.
There you go. Well, I'm sure we got sense of humor coming up, but in the meantime, we got to put in a break before we do that. So we'll be right back. Don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I must say that I have never received such a slew of inquiries, emails, tweets, posts on Facebook asking all about the new Ace Hotel in Pittsburgh. It has made quite a splash. And we've been going after information on it since it opened, which was a while back. But finally, we caught Brent Young in town, who was the culinary partner who was originally from Pittsburgh. He'll give you his story. And we got to sample the kitchen and talk to Brent, and here he is. Brent Young, this interview has been a long time coming. I've been trying to do this. You are the culinary partner in the Ace Hotel Pittsburgh, which is like one of the most exciting things that the whole universe seems to have found about Pittsburgh. You are probably more famously known as the celebrity butcher at the Meat Hook in Brooklyn, right?
That already makes me uncomfortable as an introduction, but it's very sweet. But yes, very highly anticipated, and I couldn't be more proud to be a part of this project.
Let's talk a little bit about the genesis of this. You are a native Pittsburgher, and I thought the idea originated with you, but when we were chatting over dinner, you said you had already heard that Ace was planning to open in Pittsburgh. I don't know why. Tell me about how did this happen? Why?
As I had heard about it from a friend and customer at the butcher shop at the Meat Hook, Andrew Knowlton mentioned, just because he knew I was from Pittsburgh and I wear a Pirates hat all the time, that Ace Hotel was looking at the city. It was the year after they had opened in New York and expanded, and you know, they were exploding, and it was a very fun, exciting time. And they thought, Pittsburgh, that's amazing. You know, it's my hometown. Whatever it takes for me to be a part of this, I'll do. You know, I want good things to happen in my city. So, yeah, I started making phone calls and tracking anyone down that I possibly could to be a part of the project. Ultimately, ended up being 4 years ago. It was a very long courting process, but ended up being the right time for, you know, our expansion and my capacity to even be a part of it. And, yeah, the whole thing was a lot of flirtations, and then when we decided to get serious, we got very serious and, you know, moved in with one another. So it was, it was great, but the whole restaurant ended up coming together, you know, probably eight months.
Now, I'm going to jump around a little bit. I want our listeners to be reminded, I mean, it's not going to be a new concept, be reminded about the Meat Hook.
So the Meat Hook is a whole animal butcher shop in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, that really just wanted to subscribe to the idea that we would purchase and butcher whole animals and be completely transparent and have a whole hell of a lot of fun. Was pretty much the only thing that we knew about writing a business model. Turns out you need to do a little bit more than that to run a business. We're learning 5 years after. But the idea was just that. We just wanted to have fun. wanted to get the best quality meat we possibly could and, you know, sell it in a really unpretentious, relaxed environment where, you know, the customer is not getting, you know, necessarily what they came in for, but what they need.
You were not raised butcher. How did you fall into this?
No, I was not raised a butcher. My mother was a home economics teacher, and my father owns a third-generation flooring company, Young Brothers Floor Covering. So he gave me the entrepreneurial spirit. It's always a hard word. Never, no way. But I had been a cook through my life in Pittsburgh, and while I was a cook, I never really fancied myself a chef. And when I started cutting meat, it was something that I really fell in love with because it was a sheer interaction with a real conversation behind it with the customer, which is something you don't necessarily really get with a chef, where you express yourself more through your food. And me, I'm more of a salesman. And like, I love the physical aspect of the job, but being able to actually butcher something and then sell it and have that same food experience with the customer is incredibly rewarding. And so as soon as I started doing it, I absolutely fell in love with it.
Let's just go back and switch gears a little bit. Ace Hotel is like, it's like world famous for being hip. What is the basic concept of Ace Hotels? Every city they're in, they're different. I've been in all kinds of other Ace Hotels. This one is totally different. Give us the basic concept and how it was adapted to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's funny that anything gets, you know, when things get labeled hip and cool, but really the Ace concept has always been to integrate and be a part of the community. The very first Ace Hotel Alex Calderwood made was made for musicians and artists because they needed a place to stay, you know, when coming through town. And with every city that they've, you know, expanded to and adapted to, it's been the same idea that, you know, this is a hotel made for, you know, our people, and our people just being open-minded and accepting, and no matter who you are, you can come in and, you know, get a beer, get a cup of coffee, and relax in the lounge, or, you know, or stay the night should you need to. But you know, it's less about being a hotel, but more just about the idea of hospitality and being welcoming. And because all of the hotels have, you know, been a part of interesting art communities, it's just who's embraced that spirit. It's a very young spirit, which is, I think, gets to be synonymous with hip. You know, yeah, like hip can be a bad thing. Hip can be a good thing too, that it's, you know, it's a fun contemporary place to be where you know that if you go to the bar, like, you can have an interesting conversation and, you know, and it's going to change. You're going to meet new and different people all the time.
Now, where you are, where you opened this hotel, I may be the only person still alive who remembers that it was a former YMCA,
yeah.
But I do remember, and it's an iconic building and an anchor of this East Liberty community. Just tell our listeners a little bit more about the facility.
Sure. So, I mean, when people say, you know, why Pittsburgh, you know, I implore them to come visit the hotel because the building is what really tells the story of the hotel and the here and the now of Pittsburgh. So this building is a YMCA that was built in 1908. And while it operated as a YMCA for over 60 years, it's laid dormant for the past 40. So in order to actually preserve the historic nature of the hotel, they needed a tenant that was, you know, A, going to generate revenue, but also do something diverse for the hotel itself. Because, I mean, the YMCA, it has a gym, it has a ballroom, it has a lobby area, it has, you know, a restaurant. But it, so it has, you know, these tentacles of opportunity that, you know, you need understanding and a real community to support the entire thing, because it can't just survive as a bar, it can't just survive as a coffee bar, it can't just survive as a restaurant. It needs to be truly a part of the community, which is what ACE strives to do, and what's also, I think, what a YMCA strives to do. So the whole project as a unified project really just makes sense. It's not just singular. It's really about the whole building and the whole community.
I mean, I followed this, but I don't know what the turning point was. All of a sudden, you were out there, and everybody from the neighborhood and other places in town too, but particularly impressive is people from the neighborhood. A lot of this reinvigorated East Liberty, high-tech startups, high-tech establishment, all kinds of people, creative designers, started showing up in the lobby after work. How did you get this word out without making, I mean, I didn't see any big splash.
You know, the best things that you hear about are word of mouth. You know, we put a lot out for the job fair just to make sure that, you know, people knew that we were hiring. And I feel like when you hire the right people, you accumulate a great team. And a great team has, you know, all of their resources as well. So they want to be a part of the community. They're going to tell their friends about it. And everyone else is going to tell their friends about it. So all we have to do is make sure that it's a good experience, which, you know, is no small feat. And you got to get, you know, you got to provide good food and good service and, you know, quick drinks. And, you know, hopefully the rest falls in line after that.
Well, I mean, part of this whole success is that your staff is fabulous. I don't know where you got all these people, but one's better than the next. Now, you have a wonderful manager. You also, I want to talk about the restaurant, which is fairly exceptional here, Whitfield, named for the address of the place. And you have two outstanding chefs there. Do you want to just mention your staff a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, so the staff and, the, I mean, the team of the entire hotel and the restaurant is fantastic. Bethany Zazula, our executive chef, she's like a sister to me and was from the second that we met. You know, we're both from the Pittsburgh area. We like drinking beer and don't like taking shit from anyone. So we really get along. And, you know, from the first conversation that we had about food, it was really just about the approachability of wanting to make food that is very, very welcoming to your friends and your family and has heritage to it, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel in order to impress people. You can impress anyone with a really good hug, and like that was the idea behind you know, the dinner menu. Our pastry chef, Casey Shively, we first met because she was doing a stage at the butcher shop in Brooklyn at the Meat Hook. And she hung around for, you know, the better part of 6 months working on her days off, and until she was offered a phenomenal job at Momofuku Co. And then after that started pastry under Brooks Headley at Del Posto. Worked for Del Posto for a number of years and was kind of getting the itch to move out of New York. And, you know, was kept in contact with her and was able to ring her into the project in Pittsburgh. And, you know, the two of them couldn't be a better fit or a better team.
I mean, I will give my testimony as I'm not a dessert eater, and I had both of them, and I love them both. What are some of the highlights of this menu?
It would sound a little obvious for the butcher to talk about the beef program, but I am particularly proud of it. And the whole thing was definitely an experiment to see whether we could get whole animals, you know, into the restaurant, butcher them on site, but also be able to fill all of the holes of how a restaurant needs to operate. You need enough cheeseburgers and you need enough bar steaks in addition to, you know, the big name steaks of your ribeyes and porterhouses, to design the whole thing so that it works, it's approachable, it's priced properly, and people are happy with all of it. So, while we don't wave the flag of being a steakhouse, we have a very serious butcher program that I couldn't be more proud of. And it's grass-fed, grass-finished from Jubilee Hilltop Ranch in Bedford, PA. Neil Salyards is the farmer there, and the man would never admit to it, but he's a genius. And he's a retired dairy farmer and consultant that knows animal husbandry and animal nutrition better than anyone I've ever met. And he really knows how to raise grass-fed beef. So the product that we have, we're very, very happy and very proud to serve.
And, of course, we've got our Jamison Farm lamb, which is local as well.
Of course.
Which is excellent. The food program is great. You also have opportunities for private dining developing. It's easy. I mean, it's comfortable. It's wonderful. The rooms are rather unique. Talk a little bit about some of the local touches or the touches that make the rooms local to the Pittsburgh culture. I mean, and the funny things, don't you have guitars hanging in the room?
Yeah. I mean, the designers from Ace had been working with local artists for a couple years in order to develop the entire aesthetic that, you know, changed over a number of years. But I think one of the coolest touches that you wouldn't really notice is the curtains in the restaurant are actually a Frank Lloyd Wright tapestry, and they're always open in order to let the light in. But if you ever want to close them, they form a continuous tapestry that's absolutely beautiful. You know, the rest of, like, even our platterware, you know, we have our dinner plates and chair plates and silverware and all of that, but everything else, for the big steaks and our shared appetizers, you know, we got plates from local antique stores, kind of just making it feel more like a family experience rather than a, you know, necessarily a curated restaurant experience.
They also have turntables in some rooms with vinyl that you can play. They've got guitars hanging in other rooms. It's a trip. But it's also very solid and comfortable. And getting to know you has been a revelation, too. I mean, you really are serious about this.
Yeah, serious about most things, but like I said, like to have a lot of fun. So, yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, I couldn't be more proud to be a part of this project, because every single person involved is as serious as I am. And, you know, we work hard. We play hard. It's a good group.
Now, you have most of your tasks covered. Usually, I'm used to looking at sleeves. Okay, and now you have something. What are those that I can't see?
They're mostly actually logos from old butcher knives. This one on the back of my arm, that's from a friend. A friend gave me this knife. That it's a butcher knife that they use in Panama. And he said the knife kind of sucks, but the logo is really cool. You want to go get a tattoo? I said, yeah, let's go get a tattoo. So they're mostly we have a really great relationship with our knife sharpener, the Ambrosi family out of New York. So when we started working with them, you know, they had an appreciation for, you know, our whole animal approach. So they started bringing us old butcher knives that, you know, from their family that nobody else really had an appreciation for. So I started my collection, and all of them had really, really cool logos. So it was an inspiration of sorts.
We're having such a wonderful love feast here. It's been a delight to have the evening with you. I just wanted you to know that I'm paying attention. I wanted Anne to know that you're paying attention, because on this man's feet are blunnies. Now, if you don't know what blunnies are, then I'm not going to explain it. Chef knows what they are, and he wears them because they are the most comfortable shoes.
The most comfortable, the most versatile.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up is a local chef with a worldwide recognition, and he's always been an award winner. So we're going to be talking to Chef Sean Culp of the Art Institute in Pittsburgh about his recent awards and also his efforts on behalf of the Youth Culinary Olympics. It's been some time since we've talked, Chef Sean Culp. We have done a lot of judging together, haven't we?
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again, and great to be on the air here. And again, you know, we've been together doing some other things, judging and so on, so it's definitely, you know, great to hear from you.
Yeah, well, you've kept really active, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the Culinary Federation Award and the Federation itself today. What is your exact title anymore, not in the ACF, but in the Art Institute?
My role here at the Art Institute is the department chair or director of the Culinary Baking and Pastry and HRM program here at the school. The department as a whole, as far as faculty goes, student retention, curriculum, and those things.
Sean, it's always seemed unusual to me that the Art Institute, which sounds like an art institute, has a culinary program, and incidentally, a very, very, very good one. How did that come about in the first place?
Well, I think you know, with any organization, they see a need for an industry. The Art Institutes recognize that there is a need for culinarians across the board. I think in today's market, I mean, there still is a shortage of individuals going into this industry. So years ago, I would imagine that the Art Institute recognized that need and probably said, you know what, I think it's smart for us to maybe open up a new program within our art schools, because essentially culinary is an art form. And they went ahead and developed the culinary program and the baking and pastry program within their organization. And today, among 36, almost 40 schools nationwide, is widely successful. And so it was a great opportunity for them to take part in it.
Is the Art Institute program headquartered in Texas?
No, actually, the headquarters of the Art Institute is here in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow!
But yeah, the parent company EDMC is based here in Pittsburgh, and the Pittsburgh Art Institute is the flagship of all art institutes, since this is where it started. This is where it all started back in, I believe, 1921.
That was before I was I started at age 10 at the Art Institute, but I was doing art.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, but yeah, the flagship is here in Pittsburgh, actually.
Yeah, well, you weren't exactly here doing anything unless you had been to a number of years that I don't remember. For those people who don't, because they're blind or whatever, don't know where you are, you're actually in what I always call the old Equitable Gas Building.
Yes. There, 420 Boulevard of the Allies, right across the street from the parking garage there on Boulevard of the Allies, for those of you who are familiar. And it's a great location, you know.
It's a lovely building. It really is
wonderful.
A beautiful building.
Yeah.
And you can eat there, right? As a member of the public.
Yeah, we have a restaurant here. It's called A Taste of Art. Actually, we just started our, we actually open tomorrow, first day of the spring quarter. We open every quarter with a new menu. It's a class, so the students go through every position in the restaurant experience through that class, from back of the house to front of the house. They design the menus. They do the R&D work for the menus, develop the recipes, cost out the recipes. So there's a big learning experience there. And then they also see the live fire of the restaurant experience within their curriculum at the Taste of Art. And it's, you know, it's great because the outside community and administration and faculty here at the Art Institute can come up and have lunch for a very reasonable price, and also give back to the student because the student's actually learning throughout the process.
Now what actually got us together for this particular program segment was that you just recently won the AFC Award for Cutting Edge Chef. I guess we should start off by saying, what is the AFC?
It's the ACF. It's the American Culinary Federation.
I looked at it and I thought to myself, that doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah, it's the ACF, the American Culinary Federation. And, you know, basically it's pretty much the biggest organization of chefs and cooks in America. And I've been a part of it my whole life. Recently, I was awarded the Cutting Edge Award, which is given out to chefs in the industry and recognized nationally for their leadership and mentoring skills. And I was awarded this award particularly because I just transitioned into a coaching role with Team USA. And I am currently the coach of the Youth Team USA 2016, which we are getting prepared to compete in Erfurt, Germany in the Culinary Olympics this October.
How old are the is the competition there? I mean, they're youth, right?
Yeah, the youth team, the members are all under 25 years old.
Oh, that's still not that young.
But there's a big time one as well, right? There's one for, I feel like, senior people as well as the youth.
Yeah.
One.
So there's different brackets. Like, okay. I said, I've been a part of Team USA. I was on Team 2012 on the U.S. regional team. I competed at the Olympics with U.S. regionally in 2012, and we got silver, and we got fourth ranked in the world. Then I tried out again and made it on Team 2016, the national team for the United States.
Uh-huh.
And I competed with Team USA on the national level at the Culinary World Cup in Luxembourg in 2014. Uh-huh. We were awarded two gold medals and third place overall in the world.
Yeah, you're doing much better than it. I mean, historically, for some reason, the American teams never did any good, did they?
Well, you know, I mean, we had a great team in the 80s, 90s even. In the Culinary Olympics, I think the U.S. fared pretty well. Now, I can't speak for the other competitions that are out there. I know there's very many, you know, the Bocuse d'Or and all these others. I know the U.S. did really good in the last Bocuse d'Or. We got silver in second.
Oh, yeah, it's the Bocuse d'Or that we haven't traditionally done, except last year we did move up. But all the Scandinavian people kept winning the Bocuse d'Or, right?
Yes, the Scandinavian chefs are pretty much our biggest competitors.
Why?
They're really, really great. I mean, they're, you know, when it comes to the kitchen, they're fierce, they're relentless, and they have what it takes to win. Another note to make about the, you know, Scandinavian is they're very supported by their, you know, their country.
That's what I understand.
I can definitely say that our country, if we, you know, if I went on the street right now and asked just a random person, do you know that we have a culinary team in the United States? They probably wouldn't know what I was talking about.
Right.
They would probably say, you know, oh, you cook for the sports players. No, we have an actual culinary team, you know. So that's the reaction we get a lot. But in Scandinavian countries and European countries, it's a big deal over there, and they're really supportive of their team. And I think that's a big contributor to their success. I really do.
Are they scary, I remember talking to Keith Kognar about it because he was on that the Culinary Olympics. The competition, is that scary, or do you just love it, the adrenaline rush?
No, I definitely love the adrenaline. For those of us who are on the team competing our whole career, and it's something you work yourself up to, and it's a goal of yours to kind of, you know, make a team such as the United States Culinary. And, you know, I think that once you get into that mode and you're on that level and you make the culinary team, competing in these international competitions, it's definitely an adrenaline rush. And it's a huge honor, because just imagine you're over there competing and you're representing the chefs of America. And that's a pretty big responsibility, right?
I'd be scared out of my mind.
It's a big honor. It's a huge adrenaline rush, and I really love it.
Well, I mean, there must be a big audience for this kind of competition as a result of all the Food Network stuff now.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, with shows like the Food Network, the Cooking Channel, and the others, society is more educated in food than ever, and I think that's where the insurgence of the popularity of this industry and then the craft and people being educated on healthy food, healthy eating. I think eating habits in general has changed since I started cooking professionally. And you see cuisine evolving into a direction where it's more sustainable, it's more healthy, smaller portions. What type of trends are shaping our industry today? And I think it's going to keep continuing with the, you know, like I said, with society's understanding and their involvement with our industry now.
Was it sort of like the Oscars or the Country Music Awards, Sean?
Yeah.
You got to walk up there and then you got to accept and say give a little speech.
Actually, you mean for the award or for
yes,
the
yes, yeah, for the award.
Oh, for the award. Actually, you just, you know, it wasn't a speech. It was just going up and getting recognized.
Okay.
But I think for, you know, the major awards like Chef of the Year, there is a little speech attached to that. But for the Cutting Edge Award, it was just going up, getting recognized in front of the organization and so on. So
you've got another cliff to climb yet. You've got to be Chef of the Year yet, right?
Yeah, you know, that's my next thing.
good.
I'm going to try for it.
Good man. Okay.
Keep going with it, yeah.
Now, before we went on air, we talked a little bit about enrollment. You say more and more people are looking for this culinary education. And yet I said that we have a lot of restaurants opening, and it's not just Pittsburgh. It's all over the country. And all the chefs and restaurateurs I talk to complain that they can't find staff, kitchen staff. They can't find enough people to cook. Now, what is the disconnect here between the numbers you're turning out in culinary school and the fact that there's so much shortage of staff in kitchens, restaurant kitchens?
I mean, I think that can be contributed a couple factors. One, the students are coming into school, gaining an education, especially for the students who are coming to a school like ours at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, who are gaining a bachelor's degree in their particular field, culinary management or whatever, and spending 4 years here at the school. While they're going to school, they're working the whole time, you know, whether it's a line cook position or whatever they're doing. And at that four-year mark, when they're completed with their bachelor's degree, they're pretty much ready to go into a sous chef or some type of management role at that point. And I think that's where, you know, most of the management, culinary management bachelor students go into. As far as the associate students, I think another factor would be they're seeing all this glamorous stuff on the Food Network, and I think maybe some of the students that are enrolling in a culinary program might think that after they graduate, they're all of a sudden a TV star, or, you know, they want to go right into the executive chef position, where that's not the case. I think with any industry, not just culinary, but I think with any industry that you go into, you're going to be starting at an entry-level position, whether, you know, and in particular in our industry, it's going to be either line cook or, you know, garmanger, salad prep, those type of things. And maybe those individuals who had that glamorous outlook on the industry, maybe they fall out of the industry once they realize what it actually takes to be successful in this industry. And maybe their expectations after or even during school, they realize that they're not going to be a TV star or whatever. Maybe they figure out that's not for them. You know, this industry isn't for them anymore, and they either go into another industry or whatever. So I really, you know, with the amount of food service outlets out there now, and, you know, food trucks, and I know in Pittsburgh in particular, we have a ton of new restaurants opening up on the horizon here in Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh is booming as far as food goes. It's great. It's actually great to see. Enough. I mean, we have so many people interested in this industry and going to school for it that there is still a shortage of people going into the workspace. We're forwarding students to food operations all the time here in Pittsburgh, and I guess there's still not enough to fill the demand. So
Now tell me this. I know this is a tough question. I know it varies geographically, but give me an idea of what a sous chef might earn or an executive chef in Pittsburgh, and then compare it to what the same position would bring salary-wise in New York.
Well, I mean, like you said, that's a difficult question to answer, because I think there are so many different establishments there. It would almost, to give you a salary, it wouldn't really kind of make sense. I don't know if that makes sense at all, but so many different levels of places, everything from your low-end tavern who has a sous chef at it, but, they only have a staff of three people, to a big hotel like the Omni William Penn. So to compare sous chef salaries to those two establishments would be apples to oranges. I would think that a salary range might be appropriate. Sous chefs in Pittsburgh, I mean, I think anywhere from low 30s to maybe in the 60s, low 60s, high 50s. I think that would be the range for sous chefs in Pittsburgh.
And that would be 4 years of culinary school?
I don't think necessarily 4 years. I mean, it depends on the establishment. You see job ads out there for sous chefs. I mean, there might be a culinary degree preferred. There might be a high school diploma preferred. In some of the bigger hotel chains like Ritz-Carlton's and so on, you might see a bachelor's degree required. So it all, again, I think looking at the requirements, it all depends on the establishment. I think there's such a vast array of establishments out there in this industry that you really can't say one particular thing to the other. So I think it's all depending on the level of the facility and the operation.
Yeah, well, you're right. And I guess on the positive side, you could say there are so many different types of positions to suit many lifestyles that all kinds of people can find some sort of use for their training, the culinary training, huh?
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Oh, listen, we should really talk more often.
Keep
me up to date on what you're doing. And I'm sure our listeners will be happy to hear that we're going to be making a big splash in the Youth Culinary Olympics.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
definitely. Sean, again, continued success, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was good talking to you again.
You too.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
I guess we should have told you at the beginning of the program that the theme was sort of like a local connection, tooting Pittsburgh's horn just a little bit. So we were always pleased to have the opportunity to do that, right, sweetheart?
Right.
And
except for Kenji.
I understand. I understand. We'd adopt him if we could, though.
I would adopt him in a heartbeat. Yes.
So Kenji, if you come in this way, you're joining us in Pittsburgh and you're not leaving, because we want your food lab right here. And that's all we have for this week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.